Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A good day to truth and movies. Theron stars and Theron script too in Atomic Blonde. We ask, will it bomb? Also, Sheet gets real in A Ghost Story, David Lowry's haunting meditation on time, bereavement and pi. And what's this? Only Mr. Lowry himself popping in to the show to set up this week's film club Under the Skin. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. On your Truth and Movies this week, David Jenkins.
Hi.
Hi, David. And Adam Woodward.
Hello.
All right. When's David Lowry getting here?
Soon. He's in a cab, I think, on his way.
Is he? That's so exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the biggest, like, director? You've done Chris Nolan, haven't you?
Yeah. What do you mean by done?
Yeah, in the sense that you've met him and interfaced, you know, intellectually and shared ideas and maybe inspired him a little bit. What about you, Adam? What's the biggest name you've sat across a mic from?
Not a directing name, but I've interviewed Arnold Schwarzenegger and, more excitingly, Kermit the Frog.
No. Oh, yeah, that's big, actually, too. And how did that work?
Well, I went to the hotel in central London where they were doing the interviews.
Right.
And waited in the sort of press pen area and then went in and sat down and spoke to him.
And across the table from you was Kermit the Frog?
He was sat as close to me as you are now.
Really?
When you came in the room, was he like playing with his smartphone and just wouldn't make eye contact with you?
Actually, what was fascinating was that Kermit is actually operated by...
No!
A man,
well, stop.
Who's a sort of lovely, crusty hippie type, and he was sat on the floor with Kermit above him, you know, operating him. And so I came in and started speaking. The guy's name's Steve. I started speaking to Steve, and then the second the PR gave us the cue to start the interview, he suddenly sprang into life, Kermit. And suddenly I wasn't talking to Steve anymore. I was speaking to Kermit. It was bizarre.
I'm quite shocked at the notion that we would basically rupture the omerta over the fact that Kermit's actually operated by a hippie fella. You're all right with that, aren't you? We're a grown-up thing. I quite like the idea of us actually just pretending that Kermit exists.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he does.
Yeah. That's quite exciting. Hey, listen, if you'd like to sit across the room with some really famous people in film, you can join us at the London Podcast Festival, hey?
Wow.
Yeah. It's Sunday the 17th of September, our bit. 9:30 we're going to be there in the evening at King's Place in sunny London town, and tickets are available from the King's Place website.
Someone's already been in touch with me over Twitter saying they've bought tickets purely so they can make disparaging remarks about Terrence Malick in my presence.
Oh.
So, you know, there's...
Why would you go off on one?
Well, I don't think I will, but, right, you know, there'll be stern-ish words.
Right. They're
in
coming
response
to the festival with Malick aforethought.
Yeah. Very, very good.
Listeners, if you want to get in touch, you can email us at the address is truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. Tweet David at LWLies on the Twitter or Facebook, which is the Little White Lies magazine page. Adam, if you'd like to roll those drums, we'll get on to our first film, Atomic Blonde.
This life, and someday it's going to get me killed. But not today.
Lorraine Broughton, expert in intelligence collection and hand-to-hand combat.
Agent Gascoigne was killed last night. He had an atomic bomb of information. Find out who's hunting our operatives and trust no one.
Yep, soundtrack courtesy of Now That's What I Call Obvious 80s Hits. It is Atomic Blonde, based on a 2012 graphic novel which is called The Colder City, directed by David Leitch, a former stuntman and co-director from the Keanu Reeves breakout hit John Wick. It features Charlize Theron as an ice-cold undercover MI6 agent sent to Berlin during the Cold War to investigate the cold-blooded murder of a fellow agent. And, yeah, you just heard this in the trailer, haven't you? Recover a list of missing agents. I think it looks like Elton John's Nikita video, directed by Thierry Mugler. And I noticed that the Little White Lies review took a similar line. What did you think, David?
Yeah, I think I would probably concur on those lines as well. I'm not sure I quite get your reference points there, your Elton John promo video.
Yeah.
I've not partaken in that.
Did it not look like an 80s music video to you?
It looked like a pastiche 80s music video made now and sort of desperately mining that kind of ironic nostalgia quality. Literally ice cold in that she is introduced slipping into an ice bath to cool off all her body, which is covered in bruises. Mm. And the film is essentially discovering how she got all those bruises. And it's told in a series of flashbacks to the year 1989, where the Berlin Wall is on the cusp of coming down. There's a plot that she needs to foil, whereby agents' names are going to be released.
And spy stuff.
You're kind of honest-to-goodness spy, sub-le carré kind of spy stuff. Very, very sort of mundane, obvious stuff for a lot of it. And it's like, wow, imagine a John le Carré boring spy movie, but with a supermodel instead of an old guy with a bowler hat, you know. Yeah, it didn't do much for me.
A bit of a le carry on.
Indeed.
Yeah. Adam, did you like it?
Are we calling this Jane Wick, by the way?
Oh, that's interesting.
I think we
should.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think there's a big difference between this and John Wick.
Well, there is a big difference because John Wick, the character, is introduced with a very clear motivation for what he does in the rest of the film. And I think because Charlize Theron's character, her motivation is sort of, well, there's a lot of duplicitous actions happening on her part and the part of others in the film. And yeah, it kind of teases you along and goes down various dark back alleys. And I found it a little bit kind of frustrating. There's some good action set pieces, especially in the middle. There's an amazing kind of one take. Always one of those scenes which is made to look like it was done in one take, but probably was actually pieced together in post. But yeah, it's amazing fight in on a stairwell. And Charlize Theron is, I mean, she's really put through her paces in this. And it's a pretty exhilarating scene, that.
She trained with Keanu, apparently, to prepare for this film, Keanu Reeves.
Oh, yeah.
So that's another tie-in with the whole John Wick thing. You're absolutely right. I mean, some of the action is great. Is there a character in this film that you actually care about? And is that the big difference with John Wick? Even though John Wick doesn't say a lot, him being Keanu, he's got that kind of haunted existential despair, you know, because of his dog and that, behind that furrowed brow as he goes around offing people. Whereas Charlize Theron, with the best woman in the world, all she does is just pout, look sour, and sashay around Berlin like she's on a catwalk.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think there's not only not really a character to like, but, you know, it's quite a nasty film in a lot of ways. And when the characters that you are supposed to like are dispatched, you don't really feel anything for it, for them. And there's one particular scene where someone sort of drowns in a car and the camera really lingers on their face as they're kind of gasping for their final breaths. And, yeah, I just thought it was quite a gratuitous, slightly unnecessary moment, that.
Uh-huh. I thought that the big sort of set piece in the middle, the big long take where there's this endless procession of guys who... there's not a lot of guys. It's just a few guys who just won't stay down. And when you kind of get to that point where you realise, oh, yeah, this is going to be filmed in one long tracking shot or master shot or whatever it is, I just felt so like, oh, God, this feels so such an obvious move for a film like this, you know. What can we do to make this feel a little bit more fun, a little bit more cinematic, almost give people like us a hook to write about or to talk about, which I've fallen for.
Right.
But and I think that it feels like such an empty gesture, cinematically speaking.
Interesting. And how do you feel about the other hook, if you like, that they've thrown us, which Charlize has been quite big on in her publicity for this film, which is the kind of sapphic angle? The guys don't go down easily in this film, but she does.
Yes, indeed. To be honest, I thought it was like gratuitous, and it was very like a cosmetic element of the film rather than any. I mean, there's a tiny, tiny element where you kind of think, is she doing it for king and country kind of thing? Or is there actually a bond there? And even in the end, you kind of find out that there actually isn't really any depth to it, and it's just purely a kind of bit of mid-film eye candy. Well, if you know, eye candy, if that's your kind of thing, I guess. But.
Are we being unnecessarily harsh on what is essentially a kind of throwaway action thriller?
I don't think so. I think it's competently made and put together, and certainly not the worst or most offensive action film I've seen this year or in recent years. But yeah, it's just something, it's one of those films that it desperately wants you to think it's cool, and when really it's anything but. And you mentioned earlier referencing the kind of 80s cuts which are on the soundtrack, and yeah, it just feels very obvious a lot of the choices they make here. I just think it's an unexceptional film.
What about James McAvoy?
I like him as an actor, but not in these kinds of roles where he's very sneery and excessive and kind of just over the top, I guess. Yeah, I found him quite insufferable actually.
I think when he's doing these kind of roles, he kind of defaults to sort of big scenery chewing, and I just find it a bit irritating.
Really?
But also, one of the things about this film is that a kind of personal test I have for movies, actually, which it fails on, is that it includes the song London Calling by The Clash on the soundtrack in a scene where someone is walking through London. Everyone's going to have their own personal list of sort of cinematic no-nos, like mini triggers that when you see them, they just sort of jerk you back in your seat. When that happens in a film, for me, that it's a write-off.
Right. Soundtrack-wise, it's curious because they don't have Atomic by Blondie. They don't have anything by Berlin or Drowning in Berlin, which would have been perfect for one scene. Yeah, McAvoy in his kind of muscled-up singlet appearance is a little bit...
It's a bit Del Boy.
I thought a bit Tom Hardy light, but maybe Del Boy's a better comparison. Are we worried about the fact that the director, David Leitch, is in place to do Deadpool 2?
If I was a Deadpool fan...
Were you not a fan of the first Deadpool?
No. If I was, I think I would be...
You guys, you didn't like Deadpool.
My anticipation would be unmoved by this news, but just because I think he's a quite stylistic director, and he'll probably do a fine job.
Really?
And make another terrible film.
You thought Deadpool was terrible.
Ditto. I thought it was the end of humanity. It was just the pit, absolute pits.
Wow. Listeners, I urge you to get in touch and tell me that I'm not going crazy here. Maybe we need to do an entire episode just about Deadpool, the case for and against.
Oh, we should, yeah.
All right.
Can I not be involved in that? Can I be in another time zone?
I must say,
I did watch...
Like when we do our David Lowry bit in a bit.
Indeed,
you're going to hide under the table.
Indeed, yes. Yeah.
Going back to Atomic Blonde, if I may, I'd be fascinated to read The Coldest City, the graphic novel on which this is based, because of the setting that this film takes, which is the kind of Berlin Wall falling, 1989. And yeah, it's bizarre. I think the backdrop is kind of so superfluous to what's going on. And the film opens with some context of you're in Berlin, it's 1989, the wall's about to fall, but this is not that story. And then the entire film has this kind of running, almost like newsreel track in the background that constantly reminds you of what's happening in the kind of wider political sense, which I found very irritating.
I think it's desperately trying to borrow things from elsewhere, whether it's coolness from songs or some sort of context and texture from news. And it just felt very artificial. Would you like to give it some numbers, Adam?
Sure. I'd say 3 for anticipation. Yeah, mostly just because Charlize Theron is a fantastic actor and someone who I think since Mad Max Fury Road has been kind of carving out this niche as a kind of female action heroine. And yeah, exciting to see her in this role, and probably a 3 and a 2 for my other scores. But then does this just further prove that there are so few good roles out there for women wanting to do this kind of thing? I mean, someone like Angelina Jolie tried it a few years ago with things like Salt, which wasn't, I don't think, particularly good either.
Then Wonder Woman.
Is Gal Gadot the reason that Wonder Woman has done 400 million? You don't think so?
She's good, but I don't think her alone is...
I think she's better in ways that we don't even notice.
Mm. Maybe.
I think she appeals in different ways right across the spectrum. I think that's why that film has received so much goodwill, because there are major issues with that film, I think. Had that been a male superhero, I'm not sure it would have charmed its way past people quite so much. But anyway, that is equally a story for another day. David?
I'd probably say 3-2-2. I was rather nonplussed by it all, to be honest.
I'd give it 2s across the board, and let's move on. Ghost Story, director David Lowry, fresh off the back of making or remaking Pete's Dragon for Disney, then went and, without telling anyone really, got together Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck, who he'd worked together on Ain't Them Body Saints, and shot this in the space of, I think, about 2 weeks in Texas for about $100,000. It's a remarkable film. It's about a couple, one of whom dies, and a white-sheeted ghost who returns to their suburban home to haunt, essentially, the premises. And it's a film entirely like anything else I can think of, and a very bold experiment in many ways. Well, does this film work?
Do you know what? I've had a weird relationship with this film since I saw it. It originally screened in Sundance earlier this year to kind of massive plaudits, as films that screen at Sundance usually receive. And as soon as that happens, my kind of cynicism barrier goes straight up, and I'm sort of like, oh, well, I'll reserve my judgment till I've seen it. And I thought Pete's Dragon was quite nice, and Ain't Them Body Saints, I didn't really get, to be honest. And so I was going to this film with a bit of scepticism. And do you know what? When I saw it, it was a weird experience for me, because it was like every single scene I was with it and then I was against it, then I was with it and then I was against it, oscillating constantly. But since, I've read loads of stuff about it since. Lots of people have written really nice critiques of it, and I like it more in my mind now.
Right.
And I do want to see it again.
Yeah. I should explain that the reason why this film's so challenging is that in plot terms, it really only hinges on one development. Things happen, but there's no narrative structure whatsoever. There's very little editing, you might feel, compared to a normal film. Famously, one sequence goes on for about 10 minutes with one uninterrupted take involving somebody sitting on the floor eating pie for 4.5 minutes, which is not something that you expect to see when you sit down in a cinema. And I think you're absolutely right. It takes a while to get your head around that. Adam, what were your thoughts?
I had a similar thing to David in that I wasn't really sure how I felt about it at the time and where it was kind of leading me. And I think it's one of those films that does stay with you and doesn't necessarily reveal all of its answers straight away. And I actually went back and rewatched it and kind of took a lot more out of it second time round.
I myself would very much like to go back and see it again. I think it's one of those rare films where you almost, a bit like when you go to a gallery and sometimes there's a piece of work that you don't necessarily connect with, but then you read the blurb on the side and look at the piece and understand what someone's trying to do. I really didn't, to begin with this film, and possibly all the way through, understand what David Lowry, I think, is intending and what he's trying to explore. If you had to say to people, first of all, would you say, go and watch this film?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And what would you tell them before they went and watched it?
Firstly, strap yourself in for not a bumpy ride, but an exciting and unique ride. It's almost like the human characters aren't really the central focal point. You know, you have this character who dies and then he returns in the white sheet, and it deals with this very kind of classical idea of a haunted house. A ghost is connected to its final abode, I guess. And you're basically experiencing time through the perspective of this ghost and this place. And I think what the film does that's really interesting is it almost is like a kind of concertina. There are moments like that first shot where like Rooney Mara is lugging a big suitcase and it's kind of embarrassing and it takes a really long time and you're like, why are we seeing this? And then later on you're kind of within an edit, you're kind of skipping forward like 10, 15 years or something. You're suddenly seeing the next people who have moved in this house and how the ghost is kind of interacting with them. The tagline to the film is, it's all about time, and that's a bit of a giveaway. In fact, one of the elements of it that didn't sit very well with me is there is a sequence. Is it the bit where the house is sort of two or three tenants down the road and there's a party happening. Hipsters there drinking beers and sort of waxing existential. And
I hate that.
I mean, story of my life. But then you have the musician Will Oldham, a.k.a. Bonnie Prince Billy, who actually did the soundtrack to Pete's Dragon, returning and delivering this kind of lengthy monologue that weirdly, everyone around him is in kind of raptures and by, but you're kind of, I was sort of like rolling my eyes and thinking, this is for the people who maybe don't quite get what's happening here. We need to fast track some explanation in, like, stat. How can we do it? Let's just have a kind of a drunk guy, like, holding forth at a party.
Interesting.
As a piece of writing, I think the monologue's really nice, but it kind of breaks up the sort of hushed visual tone of the film, I think, at that point. But, again, I'm sort of spent a lot of time thinking about what the hell this film is and what it's doing. And when I came out of it instantly, I was very like, that was meaningless. That had no impact on me.
Really?
Yeah, I did. I left it quite cold.
Yeah, I'm quite disappointed with myself for how much I failed to take out of it the first time. Adam?
I think that monologue sequence is one of the bits that stood out for me at the time in maybe the wrong way, and actually something which I've sort of lingered on a bit more. And I guess maybe because there's so little dialogue in the film, and aside from the amazing images in the film, the themes of it are very much left open to your interpretation, apart from that one moment where he delivers this monologue and he's kind of laying out what the film is about. And it's about kind of existence and legacy and how, you know, we're all destined just to kind of...
the impermanence of things.
Exactly, yeah. We're just destined to sort of disappear and fade into nothingness. And it's quite bleak in a way, but I think the film handles some, complex ideas in a very simple and beautiful way. And so often these days films, you know, they tell you how to feel and they explain things in a very direct way. And this doesn't do that. And it kind of, I think David Lowery shows a lot of restraint, and especially initially making it about Rooney Mara's character and how she kind of experiences grief and goes through those stages, to then sort of shift it so far the other way and really hone in on this idea of time and time passing, that feeling of time passing.
Yeah.
It's quite a brave thing to do, I think. I mean, it's only a 90-minute film, but the majority of the film is that.
It's a pie sequence, actually.
Well, yeah.
I don't know if this sounds like a bit of a cop-out, but I'm always loath to sort of be too down on essentially a kind of big name Hollywood director doing a kind of personal passion project, which is completely idiosyncratic and its own thing. And there is a kind of like nothing to lose quality to the film, which I absolutely respect. And I think one of the things that I like about it is that for me, it didn't sort of fit together. It didn't quite make sense. There wasn't a sort of obvious logic to it, which I think is maybe fueled my initial reaction to it. In retrospect, I'm kind of thinking that I kind of like the fact that he's kind of made his own rules up and he's maybe not told us what those rules are. You know, there's a sort of big flashback to the past that's kind of apropos of nothing. And at the time, I was like, why is that happening? There's no logic in that. But actually, it's like, there is a sort of to hell with logic vibe to the film, which
you needed Body Prince Billy to ride up at that point.
I know, tell you
what was going on.
So, hey, kids,
what did you make of the final shot?
I mean, we shouldn't really say. Well, I won't say
no,
what
I
it sh- is.
I loved it.
It was a way to end the film. I thought it felt like a bit of a
too neat.
Yeah, it felt like it was being trailed too often in the film.
The rating system from Little White Lies, in anticipation, during and after, I think never has it been more appropriate than for this film. Adam, what were your thoughts number-wise?
Yeah, I went 4.35 in my review, which you can read online if you want to hear more of my thoughts on it. And I think the 3 is just because it is quite intentionally a film that you're not supposed to kind of form an opinion of in the moment. As I say, I really, really kind of enjoyed it afterwards and have constantly thought about the film afterwards. So
I'd go something like 4.24.
Right.
So like was excited for it, saw it and was just a bit like bummed out, and then have thought further on it. And I will say that reading other people's takes on the film has been really interesting in that they've all been completely different. There are some people who are writing, who are kind of drawing all these kind of literary and visual art comparisons to it. And in terms of sort of critical discourse, it's almost like one of those things that you can just say anything about. You know, it's like it's quite primal in that sense. And I quite like the fact that it's generated quite a lot of different takes on it.
It's what you bring to it, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
4.25. I'm going to go with the same score as you. I was looking forward to it. At the time, I'm glad I'm not the only thicky who was like, went straight over their heads. But I do need to go back and watch it again. And maybe when I watch it again, I still won't get it, but I think I will.
I think this is going to be a nice film to watch at home for some reason. It's a very homely film. It's about like your kind of personal sanctuary, I think.
OK, well, we'll move on then. Because next up, oh my word, David Lowry is going to be here with us discussing Under the Skin.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Film Club. This week with David Lowry. Every week we take out a classic film, one you may have missed or one that needs reappraising, and dust it off and give it a once over. We've got the director of A Ghost Story, David Lowry, to select a film for us. This time around, Mr. Lowry has done us the honour of nominating Jonathan Glazer's 2013 film Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson. He dropped by a little bit earlier to talk to us about it. We began by asking him what the film is about.
You want me to describe the plot of the film?
Yeah.
Under the Skin is a film from 2014, I believe, about an alien who comes to Earth to hunt humans and in the process finds out what it means to be human.
Yeah. Interesting. Is that what it's about?
You know, there's probably a lot of other things ways you could describe it, but I think that ultimately is what it's about.
Okay. Why did you pick this?
I think it's one of, you know, my favorite films of the past 10 years. It's one of the films I most often revisit. I find myself compelled to put it on at home. I just really enjoy having it on and seeing that imagery, and I just keep going back to it. Jonathan Glazer's work as a whole is always consistently fascinating. I mean, we could easily talk for an hour about his film that he made before that, Birth, with Nicole Kidman, which is another absolutely extraordinary film that no one has seen, or not enough people have seen. But Under the Skin is more readily available than Birth is, and it's also, I know it very, very well at this point, so it's easier for me to talk about.
Are there obvious parallels with your film, Ghost Story? Did it directly, are there any things that you can feel it directly influenced in that movie?
I couldn't say that it influenced like a shot, you know. I can't say like, oh, that shot is a ripoff of Under the Skin. In fact, my previous film, Pete's Dragon, my Disney movie, has a couple of sequences that are, you know, ripoffs of Under the Skin. Oddly enough, I pulled up that movie a couple times to show the crew and say, here's what we're going for. The opening scene in particular.
Oh, I love that. But that's like Project Mayhem style, like sneaking into a massive Disney film. That's great.
But with the Ghost Story, the thing that the parallel, I think, isn't, you know, when I described Under the Skin a few minutes ago and said it's about an alien who discovers what it means to be human, that's a relatively like simplistic idea.
Right.
And it's not something we haven't seen in movies before. It's you could even describe it as relatively facile. Like it's not like the most complex idea. And yet at the same time, the movie's extraordinarily complex in the way that it deals with this very simple idea. And a Ghost Story, you can distill that down to the idea of it's about learning to let go. A very simple concept, something that's very easy to grasp onto. It's almost touchy-feely in its spiritual qualities, and yet hopefully the movie deals with that idea in a very complex way. And so that's something that I feel like there's, you know, I felt Under the Skin did. I love that it took a very simple idea and dug into it in a very provocative fashion, and it was something I hope to do with the ghost story as well.
Right. It's also about rendering the familiar unfamiliar under the skin, and slightly by adopting an almost voyeuristic viewpoint, which I thought maybe was echoed as well in a ghost story, in that there is so much of your film in which we're asked to do the work. Basically, we're just left with something and we can get on with it in whichever way we want to. And I think one of the things that happens is that you do then begin to examine everything from this detached viewpoint. Amazing film, The Under Skin. What did you think, Adam?
Yeah, I actually had seen the film initially kind of around the time it premiered at Venice, I think. So it's sort of before a lot of the buzz had been built around it. And I can't think of another film that has been sort of promoted from basically nothing to the status of like modern classic in a shorter period of time as this. I mean, it's constantly being, I think we did our own poll of our contributors, and it came out number one from the best film of the 21st century, and it seems to be one that people really hold in high regard. And so I was fascinated to revisit it, because I think initially I didn't necessarily love it, but yeah, second time round, I mean, I hadn't seen it for, I guess, 3-4 years since it came out. And there were so many things about it which just, yeah, really blew me away.
I think it was booed at its premiere. Why do you think the reaction, and certainly the box office, was not good for it? Well, why do you think it didn't catch on at first?
It's clearly not intended to be a commercial film, even with a kind of major A-list star in it. And the festival booing, I think that's just a thing that you get at festivals.
Happens.
Yeah, it happens. I was at a screening of The Master at Venice a few years before that, and that got kind of booed by some people as well. So, yeah, there's so much about this film. Mika Levi's score, especially, is something which, I mean, I hadn't rewatched the film a lot. I've got that that soundtrack on vinyl, and I play it quite often.
Yeah, I know that score intimately as I do with the movie at this point. It's a really remarkable piece of music.
Hmm. And again, the score plays such a big part in a ghost story. Have you ever been booed at a festival, Lou?
I don't sit through my own screenings, so I don't know. I very well could have been. But to the extent of my knowledge, you know, I've played at Cannes with a film, and that's like the festival to be booed at. Right. Historically, and I was in that screening when the credits hit, and there were no boos. So, hopefully that, you know, I'm sure it'll happen at some point.
Yeah, well, hopefully so. No, just because often, you know, that first friction suggests that you're doing something interesting. You mentioned the opening, though, of Under the Skin, which is right up there with my favorite ever, with A Matter of Life and Death, and probably Raiders of the Lost Ark, as the great cinematic beginnings. Is there anything you would have done differently if you were going to do a remake of a reboot, perhaps, of Under the Skin, Dave?
Oh no, goodness! I would love to. I would love for that movie to never be touched. Like, I think there's no need to, you know, for me to try to put my stamp on it, even theoretically. I just like to sit back and watch it. So what's interesting to me about that opening is that it is showing the genesis of life. It is showing the creation of life in an almost, it's odd how predictable it is with the imagery. Like, there's a very phallic image of like some object going into an orifice of some sort. And it's like, that's a very obvious, you know, imagery for the creation of life. And yet at the same time, it's so abstract that you almost don't process it as such. And it's not until the second time you see it, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that, I see what's going on there.
See, I didn't get that at all. I assumed that in as much as that was in any way a narrative device, that it was representing a journey through space.
It's that, and it's also the construction of an eyeball. Like, on a very basic, you know, like, in terms of the images you were being shown, you're seeing a pupil be constructed on a very subatomic level, in a way. And it also feels like a journey through space. I feel like that phallic image, that tube, reminds me of the spaceships in David Lynch's Dune that, you know, traverse time and space. Uh-huh. And then, of course, there's the obvious allusions to 2001 as well, the cosmic journey at the end of that film, all crammed into, like, the first, you know, minute and a half of this movie. And it's all done with abstract, you know, presumably visual effects imagery. And it's unlike... It's unlike anything. As I'm describing it right now, it sounds like, oh, of course that's how you would start this movie. And yet at the same time, when you're watching it, you feel like you're being confronted with something you've never seen before. Mm.
And it's very unlike the rest of the film. You're really good at explaining films. I don't know if you're free at all most Wednesdays to pop by. All right, well, listen, what are you going to be doing next, David?
Well, I just finished a movie that is about as different from a ghost story and Under the Skin as anything possibly could be. It's called The Old Man, the Gun, and it's a film starring Robert Redford about it's a true story about a 70-year-old bank robber. And so we finished shooting that a couple months ago, and I'm editing that right now. And it's really interesting to go back and forth between talking about a ghost story and editing that movie, because they're so diametrically opposed to one another. And yet at the same time, there's something there at the core that feels similar. And I'm excited to find out more of what that is.
Wow. Looking forward to when would that be coming out?
Sometime next year, probably around this time next year.
All right. Excellent. Well, best of luck with that.
Thank you very much.
And may you continue to evade the booze.
I will do my best.
All right, excellent. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
I really appreciate it.
David Lowery. He was nice, wasn't he, Adam?
Yeah, very nice.
You weren't here, David Jenkins.
He seemed charming.
He was saying Birth is really good by Jonathan Glazer with Nicole Kidman. Is it really good?
Pass.
Have you not seen it?
I have seen it, but I'm not the biggest fan of it. Nor Under the Skin, to be honest.
Really?
Sorry. I've given that film a couple of goes, and it's just not my thing.
You don't like anything.
No, just Under the Skin. Under the Skin is a film that I think is technically an amazing film,
right,
but I don't like it.
Do you like Sexy Beast?
I love Sexy Beast.
Right.
For me, Sexy Beast is peak Glazer, and no question.
The Ray Winston classic from back in the day.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's such a leap from this film, but you know... Enough of my yakking. What do listeners think about this?
So we had some nice listener comments this week on Under the Skin. Paul McCann tweets in to say, a magnificent adaptation of a single grain of Faber's book, a labour of love worthy of Kubrick.
And then Harry Thompson, definitely one of my favourite films, A Trip to the Cinema to See, is still one of my most memorable, visually stunning, a true piece of art with superb performance from Scarlett Johansson.
There you go. Robert Farrell, the audience is treated as intelligent and capable of understanding. Well, some of them were, Adam. Some of them. Tarkovsky would be proud, says Robert Farrell. Not even that scene at the beach with the kid on the beach.
Mm.
Wow, that's dark, isn't it?
That is a very distressing scene.
It is. All right. Anyway, that was Under the Skin, which was this week's film club. But what have you gone with for next week's show? What are we going to be doing for our homework?
Well, next week a film is being released called The Dark Tower, which is a Stephen King adaptation. And there's also the remake of It coming out soon as well.
Is there?
Yes, which hopefully we'll be doing on this very show. And in anticipation of those, we actually asked our readers and our listeners what their favourite Stephen King adaptations were.
Mm.
And we had some usual suspects, not the usual suspects, obviously, but we had The Shining and Stand By Me and a few others. But
Shawshank.
Shawshank as well. Mm. One that kept cropping up was Misery, which is Rob Reiner's film starring James Caan and Kathy Bates. So I thought that would be an interesting one to go and revisit. It's a film I've not seen for a long, long time. So.
Right.
He almost died. You have a compound fracture of the tibia in both legs, and the fibula in the right leg is fractured, too.
I'm your number one fan.
My name is Annie Wilkes.
I guess it was kind of a miracle you finding me.
In a way, I was following you.
Who followed me?
Oh, Paul, I've read everything of yours, but the Misery novels. You must be a good man, or you could never have created such a wondrous, loving creature as Misery Chastain.
Very kind.
The presumption must now be that Paul Sheldon is dead.
You... dirty bird. How could you? Misery Chastain cannot be dead.
Misery spirit is still alive.
And don't even think about anybody coming for you, because I never called them. Nobody knows you're here. And you better hope nothing happens to me. Because if I die, you die.
What a great shout. Well done, listeners. I'm looking forward to this, David.
Yeah, I've never seen the film before. I think had I been part of this... call out, I would have picked the film Carrie.
Okay.
Which is one of my all-time faves.
Well, you know what? Hopefully we'll be doing Film Club for many years to come.
Let's pencil in Carrie for 2039.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's coming up next week in Truth and Movies. Also, there's a lot of interesting films coming out next week, and we're not entirely sure which ones we're going to be looking at, partly because The Dark Tower has been so absolutely hammered by its first critical responses that they may not be doing any more previews. We'll see if we get into that. But there's also The Hitman's Bodyguard, a little bit of buddy movie banter there, and there's also An Inconvenient Sequel, and there's also Quest and Dark Knight, which is a film kind of inspired by the events in a Colorado theatre. A mass shooting
there. Anyway, do let us know your thoughts principally on Misery, because that is one film we will definitely be talking about next time around. The address of our email is truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, on Twitter at LWLies or the Little White Lies magazine Facebook page. Anything else you want to add, David Adam, before we sign off?
I'd actually like to give a little bit of a shout out to a film season on at the BFI at the moment. Actually, a film that we have discussed in Film Club, that Jean-Pierre Melville's Le Samurai. There is an entire season of his work. And even though we were a little cool on that film, I think it's a really nice opportunity to see the classics like Army of Shadows and Le Cercle Rouge and Un Flic and Le Deuxième Souffle. So, yeah, I would heartily recommend seeking
Le
those out.
Deuxième Souffle.
Le Deuxième Souffle. Should I be calling it the second breath?
Not Le Deuxième Souffle.
Le Deuxième. Well, can you give me the correct pronunciation?
To be fair, I really can't. I'm so sorry.
I hate pronunciation mockers. They're the lowest form of life.
Sorry, Adam. Anything you wanted to throw in?
I'm quite excited by the trailer which dropped this week for Darren Aronofsky's new film Mother, with Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem, which I didn't know too much about before the trailer. Have you seen the trailer?
I haven't seen it, but I've seen everyone getting excited by the trailer.
Yeah, it looks strange, and it looks like a sort of psychological sort of thriller. So very excited to see that. I think it's going to be at one of the festivals in the autumn.
The Venice Film Festival.
There you go. So hopefully we'll have a kind of hot take from it.
Are you going to the Venice Film Festival at all?
We will have someone there doing dispatches.
People. Top people.
Our spies.
Excellent. All right. Well, listeners, you know, that really is it. So many thanks to Seven Digital. That's been Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.